7 FM, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hay Fever, produced by the Portland Actors Conservatory and running from December 2nd to December 18th. In Hay Fever, the Bliss family have all invited house guests for the weekend. Artistic eccentricity and flirtation are misinterpreted and hilarity ensues. Again, that's Hay Fever, produced by the Portland Actors Conservatory and running December 2nd to December 18th. The play takes place at 1436 Southwest Montgomery Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Starting November 1st and wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m. coming up on Veterans Voice Radio. Angie will welcome Air Force veteran Phoenix to the KBOO studios to reflect on her time spent at Standing Rock. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. We'll round out the hour with Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Radio Zine presents The Bradcast, an independent investigative news show. Today's show is about the coup by Republican lawmakers in North Carolina attempting to strip power from the incoming Democratic governor. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. And as we just heard, I'll remind you again that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of the year, thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding System. Go to kboo.fm, click where it says Donate.
Good morning. This is Angie with Veterans Voice Radio. This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Today we're going to be speaking with Phoenix. She is an Air Force veteran, and she is also of the Tlingit, I believe it's called, and Haida tribes. And she recently took a trip to Standing Rock, and we're going to be talking with her today about that. And Marvin couldn't join us this morning. He is snowed out, as some of us are. And also, Phoenix wanted to be here in person as well, but due to the ice, she's not going to be here. But there are a few things that we can talk about while we're getting her on the line. It was interesting to me that Guantanamo is actually, not only is it... It's actually expanding, believe it or not. We're actually expanding some of the building projects that are going on there, which I thought was pretty troubling. And as in the last 8 years, President Obama was not able to or didn't shut down Guantanamo, as was one of his leading points in trying to get elected. That didn't happen, but now... There is a military.com news article, and we are actually building a medical clinic there right now, and that's at the cost of $8.4 million. That is happening right now. And the government is also building at Guantanamo a $12.4 million dining facility for the troops. So as these projects in Guantanamo continue to expand, one has to question whether the Trump administration is going to do anything about that. Probably it will be expanding further. And another thing that we were talking about last month was the VA, and it looks like Trump is under increasing pressure to keep the current Obama VA secretary, which is McDonald, and he is the current secretary of the VA, and what we are looking at, what we're tracking right now, is the fact that Concerned Veterans of America is it's actually kind of an incredible veterans group that isn't really connected to any other VA groups. And this group is actually a right-wing funded partially funded by the Koch brothers group. And that is who Trump is getting some of his references from when he's thinking about what he wants to do with the VA. And Concerned Veterans of America, they are a right-wing group, and it is pretty troubling because they have always leaned towards privatizing the VA. But what's interesting is they don't actually communicate with any of the other veterans groups. So privatizing the VA is something we were talking about last month, and who actually is against privatizing the VA? Well, it turns out that quite a few veterans groups are against or opposed to privatizing the VA. One of them would be the Disabled Veterans of America. Others are the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the American Legion, Paralyzed Veterans of America, American Veterans Incorporated, the Military Order of the Purple Heart, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and also Military Officers Association of America. All of these groups are against privatizing the VA, which we know would actually cost a lot more money. According to many studies that have been found, care would probably decrease. And as it is now, if you are a veteran and you live over 50 miles away from a VA clinic, you can go to a private hospital of your choice. And so that's the way it is right now. It keeps costs down. The VA is the largest provider of medical research in the United States. And it's really something that most veterans don't want. There was a poll that was done by the Veterans Voice Foundation, which was actually conducted jointly by Democratic and Republican polling firms, okay? And that is 64% of veterans opposed privatization in that poll. So that's something that we're going to be looking at in the coming months here. And there is a speaking event that is going to be going on at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House on January 5th from 7 to 9 p.m., and that's going to be part of the Drop the Mic tour by Iraq Veterans Against the War. Myself will be there, Angie, as well as some other veterans, and we're going to be talking about some of the issues surrounding the military-industrial complex. When I say Drop the Mic tour, that stands for Drop the Military-Industrial Complex. That is part of a campaign that Iraq Veterans Against the War is having as part of, it's similar to the Winter Soldier project that happened back in 2011. And that was a 3-day event that hundreds of veterans went to in Washington, D.C. and testified in front of people. And this was all recorded, this is all on YouTube. And it was made into a book as well. And so we're going to be doing a speaking event. Again, that's going to be January 5th, 7 and 9 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House. That's part of the Drop the Military Industrial Complex tour. There are a couple books, too, that some people might be interested in checking out. If you haven't heard of these already, hopefully next month we're going to be getting Jonathan Hutto Sr. on the air with us. He's somebody that I met at a veterans retreat, which was for progressive leadership in veterans movements. And he wrote a book called Anti-War Soldier, How to Dissent Within the Ranks of the Military. And this is a really interesting book. It's a very easy and quick read, but it's very packed with a lot of really good information. We're going to probably get him on the air next month, and he has come from a long line of activism. His family comes from the civil rights movement. He's done work with so many different organizations and universities, and is a highly intelligent person, a very good organizer, and also a Navy veteran. So we're going to be getting him on. Another book that is recommended is this book called Worth Fighting For by Rory Fanning. You may or may not have heard of him. He was a former Army Ranger, and he turned into a war resister after his time in the service, and he wrote this book called Worth Fighting For, and I'm hoping to get him on the air as well. So that would be really, really an interesting conversation. There is a Facebook page for us too. If you haven't found out about that, it is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 97 FM. That is our Facebook page. So it looks like we have Phoenix here with us today. Really excited about speak with her. And is she with us?
Good morning. Yes, I am with you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm sad that you couldn't make it here to the studio, but at least we have you on the phone, and at least we're not compromising your safety by driving in this crazy weather.
Yes, thank you for that. A lot of us are really caught off guard by the weather. That's not very typical for Portland.
Yeah. So I wanted to start out with first your military experience. Can you tell us what branch you joined and what you did and why you actually ended up joining the military in the first place?
Absolutely. I'd love to share that. Thank you. I am an active duty Air Force veteran. I had known years and years ago as a small child, actually, that I was interested in joining America's forces. It might be kind of funny, but I recall watching Top Gun and just being completely enthralled and thinking to myself, one of these days, I'm going to work with fighter jets. And sure enough, I did. And I was in the aerospace control and warning systems career field, working in specifically air battle management, and then later becoming an instructor for our surveillance technician course.
Interesting.
I come from a family of all branches of military, whether that be active duty, reserve, or guard, Marines, Navy. My father retired 20 years Coast Guard. My uncle's Air Force, and I spent a lot of time on military bases and moving around a lot.
Okay, so you pretty much knew that was something that you wanted to end up doing. What was your military experience like? How did you like it?
I found that I took away so many positive lessons. I don't feel like I would be the person I am today without my military experience. It really forces us to mature at just such an intense rate when it comes to so many unique things within the scope of responsibility and working together. And but I did also have some of my own challenges in personal conflict with what it is that I found that we were actually standing for in the end. But otherwise, there was a lot of really good opportunity and a lot of good education, even if it wasn't something I was fully in support of.
So what years were you in the military, and when did you leave?
I left 2 days after my 18th birthday, after I graduated in 2003, and then separated in 2007.
Okay. And so, from that time on, what have you been doing? I understand that you've been doing some work with veterans. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I entered into the medical field, as a lot of us would understand that transition from military life into civilian life was a lot more abrupt than I had imagined. And I found myself very lost, like many others. And I figured out that there's this thing called a GI Bill and that I could use it to go to school. And I tried to pick something as practical as possible. And that opened up so many other opportunities for me and understanding about myself, that there's this piece that I wasn't consciously aware of, and that service piece, that we all want to contribute to our community, and that was a vessel for that for me. It eventually led into exploring what it is to work with people in communities that face unique challenges, especially within the veteran community. So once I worked in the medical field for a while, I went back to school to further my education, actually in a pre-med program, and I ended up abandoning that and going into the social work field, where in the last 4 years here in Portland, I started just in the beginning rejuvenating a student-led program at a local community college and turned it into something else, where there was a replenishing of scholarship funds for veterans just in need of really anything, but specifically, you know, books, and creating situations where there's some more peer support going on to help each other transition into civilian life. And eventually that led up to a position that I took at Portland State University as the Women Veterans Outreach Coordinator. And I found that even more fulfilling to have that much more interaction with my community. And so specifically since then, I've was with the Oregon Army National Guard as their suicide prevention program manager, and have worked on consult with other nonprofit organizations, helping bridge the gap between military community and civilian community, just understanding that there are some unique needs and differences.
Yeah, there definitely are some different unique differences, and I think that's one of the reasons why privatizing the VA would be such a horrible thing to do, because veterans have such a different set of needs and challenges than most hospitals, mostly any other hospitals, equipped to deal with, or even has the understanding of how to deal with something like that. So you're an Indigenous person, and how did that affect your military experience or life in any way, or not so much?
I am in fact Indigenous of the Tlingit and Haida tribes in Alaska, and I feel that I've gone through my own personal journey in understanding what that means in our society. And I feel like during my service, I actually really was not fully aware of that. And but now that I look back on it, that there were definitely, as you know, there's been some issues surrounding the gender differences, and that it can be an unsafe space for females at times, and there's specific needs of support. And I've definitely realized within this ranking structure of society that not only being a female, but also being Indigenous did not put me in a position to succeed from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I've also gotten the opportunity, actually at Standing Rock, to speak with other Indigenous veterans who not only mirrored that, but there were others who had such an intense experience in that, very much specifically impacting their well-being as a service member.
So What actually led you to go to Standing Rock, and what inspired you to go there to begin?
I felt that on the first level was very personal. Being Indigenous and seeing the struggle of my people has been extremely difficult, that it's so ongoing, and that this voice of these people is quieted so often that they're often forgotten. There was a poll that was done recently that were asking children in school today about whether or not the natives lived before us or if they live today. And actually the results are surprising, that a lot of the children were under the impression that this was a race that no longer lived today. And that's very disturbing. And to see this huge movement and this light being shown on the injustice that's happening, and that it's happening on such a multi-layer aspect for our whole community, when we're talking in environmental service and or environmental impact, as well as the government's impact and how we're treated as a nation, that I was extremely excited that this opportunity was coming up. And I felt it in my heart to go, but it just didn't feel quite the right time to go. And then I heard that there was this large veterans movement, and I felt it doubly strong to go. And that's exactly why I went.
Yeah, I read an article on Vice, and it was very interesting. It said that it was talking about how the surge of veterans group was actually had quite a bit of chaos involved in it, and it wasn't necessarily what all of the elders wanted to have happen. And there was definitely some criticism of the veterans being there, and I think it's a complicated issue. What was your experience like with that? Because that you were there at that time when over 2,000 veterans arrived.
You are absolutely right. There are conflicting feelings, and I was able to bear witness to those before we even hit the ground in Standing Rock as an organizer for veterans for Standing Rock in this national self-deployment. There were concerns from the beginning that the group wasn't coming in fully aware and completely being considerate to what it means to show up and how to do that and how to bring the utmost respect for the people who are already there, specifically the tribes. And being there in person really substantiated those concerns, and that it is a complicated feeling to kind of tease out when the movement is very positive in itself, but to see that the negativities that it brought with it, it's definitely difficult to speak about those and overshadow the positive things.
Yeah. Well, I think that too, whenever you're mobilizing 2,000 or more people and it ends up to being a little bit chaotic, it's almost like you have to expect something like that to happen, because it's not like we as Americans are used to doing this all of the time. And I think that there's going to be some growing pains involved with mass organizing. And that's just the way it's going to be. It's not going to be just this easy thing to do. So
I find that interesting that you say growing pains, as if there is this understanding that the Veterans for Standing Rock group is, you know, an established group that will continue to grow. I think that's a question that is out there. I also think that with such a large movement with so many people, it has to always be dealt with delicately, and to understand that a group of people should be approached with thorough planning and thorough consideration for the unique needs of the group that is going, and also the unique needs of the group that is already there that will be joining. And one of my main themes in a lot of the conversations I've been having so far is to have empathy and understanding, but also hold a firm level of accountability. And some of the the mistakes that I saw happen were things that we were not deliberately holding ourselves and each other accountable for. But some of these things that were happening in a negative manner at Standing Rock were things that were brought to the attention before we had even left.
What are some of the positive things that came out of this? I mean, for example, the forgiveness ceremony was really pretty incredible. Were you there for that?
I was. That was absolutely powerful. I felt like there was so much emotion in the room.
Would you like to describe that for the listeners in case they haven't seen the videos?
It happened so that the blizzard had happened, and we were in the pavilion at a hotel down the road, and many of us veterans that were sleeping in there. So you can imagine this large gymnasium with all these, you know, this romantic image of all these veterans with their old service uniforms on and their sleeping rolls off to the side. And some of the veterans that felt it in their heart to be a part of this ceremony and an apology had put on some of their dress uniforms. And I was absolutely taken by surprise that this was something that was going to happen. And I think a lot of people shared that same sentiment. And it almost seemed surreal when it was happening. And for people of today to recognize that the indigenous group suffered at the hands of our military in prior generations, and to take that initiative and say, I see that this has happened and I don't want to be another facilitator of this. You know, I apologize for what has happened to you. I take that empathy and that sympathy and I offer that to you. And I feel like that is what that was. Mm-hmm. And that was really moving in a show of unity.
What do you think are some of the things that need to continue to happen on part of veterans to continue this work?
I think this opportunity was rich with lessons that we can grow from. We had talked about some complications that had happened while we were there, and they were definitely talked out on the ground when it came to being culturally sensitive and coming in to join the group rather than take charge. And those are lessons that we can take with us. And also the lessons of sustaining this relationship and that this was a big moment to speak out. And we got to show the country and the world that there are veterans who support this and veterans who support peace and a better future for our children. And I really think that the important part is just continuing that work and continuing those personal relationships and continuing that in our workplace and continuing that when there are other opportunities like this that come up.
Yeah, and it's amazing that, I don't know if you've heard this or not, but there was an oil spill only miles away from the protest site. 176,000 gallons of crude oil leaked into the creek, 150 miles from the Dakota Access protest camp. And this is just incredible to me that people talk about the fact that we need all this oil and we need this pipeline here, but here it is bursting not that far away from where the protest is happening, or I should say the protection site or the demonstration site. It's really incredible. What do you think might end up happening with all of this? I mean, they supposedly they stopped the easement. They don't have the easement, but they're drilling anyway. And how do you think this is going to turn out? And just your opinion.
That's a really good question. I think so many of us are wondering, and I would have to say, isn't that disturbing? I mean, if we really take a moment to listen to what you had just shared and say, gallons in gallons of the substance has spilled even near the site, and just really kind of soak in the impact on the environment and the people. But this specifically was near the protest site, but this is on indigenous land. This is the land that they live on, the land that, you know, they were resigned to live on and will continue to live on, because there's really no other option of preserving themselves as people, and the effect that has, and the fact that it was rerouted through that land. And really sit with that thought, and really sit with that thought that somehow we're convinced that this is the only way we can continue to live. Well, this is the only way right now that we've invested so much money into, that there are particular people profiting from this, and that the people that are trying to bring us into the future of a better generation with different technology and different way to sustain our energy are being underserved. And there's a lot of voices that aren't getting heard that really need that attention now. And what do I think is going to happen? I would love to say that this is, we're going to have a wake-up call as a nation, and all these people that have big money invested in this, and our government is going to step in. And I don't think it's going to be that easy. It's going to take our continual pressure as people, as unifying together across any gender or race or religion, to do so. Because the outcome really is unknown right now. That right now there was a denial letter, but as it stands, as my understanding, that the fees are just going to get paid. And the penalties are going to get paid, and the work is going to continue on this pipeline.
That appears to be what is happening now. But when I was at a training not that long ago, we were talking about what will be the movement that will bring us together and propel us forward, because we're still in a Reagan era of politics right now, is what our many sociologists think, and I think that that's probably true. And the question was, what is going to be the movement that propels us forward and brings us together in a holistic way, all of whether it's humanitarian or whether it's a anti-war group or whether it's an environmental group. And I truly feel that this is the thing that is uniting us. And that's because so many different, when I say this, I mean the event at Standing Rock. And I think that this work is only just begun. What are your thoughts on that? Because I feel like this is just the beginning of a long, long battle. And it really isn't the beginning for the Sioux tribe. This has been going on for hundreds of years for them. But for the rest of the U.S., I think that this has kind of been something like a big cup of coffee in the morning. Like, okay, this is actually something that is a real big deal, and I want to have something to do with this. I think that that's definitely something that's going to unite us.
I would have to agree with you. In my head, as I'm listening to you, and you're asking me, you know, what movement will this be? And I would definitely say we're amidst that movement right now. But Standing Rock is a huge unifying position for us. And that the one thing that came to mind also as you were talking was, a climb uphill is never fast to begin with. And that there is not one thing or one moment that's really going to drive this. It's a lot of continual moments strung together. It's going to be big, big moments like Standing Rock, and it's going to be smaller moments in smaller towns of people who are protesting, you know, and hashtag not my president. I've seen so many other smaller towns with maybe just five people together, on the street side trying to express this. And I really say it's across the board. It really is.
Yeah. There's so many different things that could, there's so many different overlying aspects of this that can come together. But I feel that being culturally sensitive to this issue and not overrunning or whitewashing this movement is really important. And that's why I really wanted to get your perspective, is because you are part of the First Nations. And so how do you think that, if people want to participate, how do you think that they can be more sensitive or more aware of some of their actions or thoughts or just how they want to participate?
I'm really glad you said that. That is absolutely a conversation. That's a narrative that's going on. And what happened at Standing Rock as well is that there is this want and this need to come to the aid of the Indigenous community and to stand in solidarity. But there has been that blurred line of whitewashing. And I think it's really important to maintain the assistance there by being as educated as possible. I think Standing Rock was a really good example of walking delicately by coming in and being there to join, to assessing where you're most useful, by assessing pre-existing customs already, you know, set in place and structures. And what had happened at Standing Rock is, with good intentions, it was more of the, I'm coming to save you and I'm coming to relieve you and take over, was like that mixed message there. But in such good intentions. So really being aware of really working together in partnership versus I'll do this for you or I'll speak for you. And I know that there are people who actually don't know what Standing Rock is. And I've had a few of those conversations before I had left. And, you know, some people think it's a monument or a town or an actual rock. And so...
I think that actually speaks to the media blackout on this, don't you think?
I would have to agree, definitely. That has a huge contribution to that.
Everybody knows where the White House is.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a really good point. And that was something that was really lacked a presence while we were there, was where were the big media news reporters? Where was CNN?
Well, they were probably in their closets somewhere.
Right? Where was Fox News?
Well, they were probably in the Trump Tower.
Good point. And this really speaks to not just media, but our education in our schools. Actually, if I could just kind of piggyback on that, is, you know, our colonized version of education, that there's really so little in the way of education. And the little bit that is out there is absolutely a different version being told. And I recall the group that I had specifically drove up to Standing Rock with, we stopped at Battle of Little Bighorn. And my first impression upon arriving was, this is probably a burial ground for the military soldiers, as an observation. And it turns out that indeed, primarily it was. And there was a large rock with something, you know, written on all four sides, and this particular side that I was looking at had said a little bit about the battle and about the soldiers who had died at the hand of hostile Indians. And I feel like that really speaks to the miseducation, and that really speaks to how things really can be put into different filters and handed to us as citizens of this country, specifically within media and or the lack thereof. So it's really having those conversations with each other and understanding that we're at a disadvantage and that we don't deserve to be miseducated. And if we have to take that responsibility on ourselves, so be it.
Well, and that's why we're talking today. And again, we're talking with Phoenix Air Force veteran. This is Angie, and this is Veterans Voice, and we're talking about veterans in Standing Rock. So, what were some of the other things you noticed with so many veterans at Standing Rock all at once? I'm just really curious about this. 2,000 veterans show up. Was it just, did people have things to do? How was it? Was it complete chaos like Vice said, or was it just everybody just marched to a front line? can you describe that situation?
There's so much I want to share with you.
Because that's really interesting.
That one thing, it was so loaded with experience to witness, and there really were absolutely more than 2,000 veterans, which is amazing. There was upwards to, you know, maybe 3,000 or 4,000. Uh-huh. And I'm not sure if that number was this particular movement or veterans that were already there. but there was, when you put that many people together, there was absolutely, you know, there was some chaos and disorganization that was intensified by the blizzard that had hit. And a lot of the veterans had shown up the day prior or the day of this announcement being made.
Wow.
That the pipeline was, you know, access was going to be denied, supposedly. And so the plans had changed a little bit, that there was going to be this show of solidarity, and we're all going to, you know, maybe create a circle around all the protectors. Or there was also a plan to, you know, be in ranks and stand all the veterans between the law enforcement and the rest of the camp. And so as those plans had changed, this had turned into a different mission. There was celebration and education and conversations being had, but there was also a lot of shelter building going on to prepare for the veterans to stay there over the coming days, but then also to help alleviate those who were already in camp. I spoke specifically to Northwest Indian Veterans Association president, who said, you know, we are here as veterans and we're going to come to the aid in any manner or fashion that's going to present. So whoever's been here for a while, we're here to alleviate them and let them rest.
Mm-hmm. And this seems really, it's actually a pretty historical situation that many veterans and this many Indigenous people are coming together. It's actually very interesting, and it's a historical thing. It has not happened. So this is actually a first, and I think that's pretty incredible. And I'm wondering and actually pretty excited about what they're going to do in Flint as well. And I think that we should be keeping an eye on that to see what happens. So as the veterans are standing there, and now are things pretty much disbanded for the time due to weather and Standing Rock at this moment?
As far as the veterans leaving?
As far as the veterans and the rest of the people, are they still there?
Yes, there are absolutely people still there that I'm in contact with every day. There are groups here that I mentioned before, the Northwest Indian Veterans Association, who are putting together supplies to bring out there to help sustain those who are actually still there, who need help with heating. So they need wood and propane. Several have left, specifically the veterans, but there are people that understand that this is ongoing. And then it's not over yet, so they're absolutely staying.
And what's going on with, I've read that people are going to get fined, they're shutting down roads, you can get upwards of $1,000 fine for delivering supplies to the campsite. Have you noticed any law enforcement enforcing that?
I was really skeptical that this was a scare tactic, and how unfortunate is that? I would like to add that people would be kept from crucial life-sustaining supplies as far as food and heating. And I feel like I didn't get the opportunity to witness that because I feel that there would have been so many more repercussions trying to enforce that on the influx of thousands of people, specifically veterans, and what kind of press, that would be, what kind of reaction within our society that would be. And I feel like it's really easy to enforce that and press that upon singular groups of people as they can cherry pick off the group. There are definitely people, we're hearing stories, you know, every day that fortunately get shared on personal Facebook sites, so we can see the truth in what's happening versus what's, you know, CNN or Fox or any other news channel is covering. But there are people being singled out. There are people going into the camps to cause trouble.
Do you think that they're plants, or do you think that they're just not aware of what's going on? Why are they being singled out? I would really like to know. Yeah.
I feel like a lot of us would really like to know.
But for the road blockades and things like that, what's the level of law enforcement apprehension what is their level of involvement with people trying to deliver supplies right now? Are they stopping people?
So far, I've not personally heard of that. I do know that that was something that had been broadcasted and had gone around. There is the road closure over the bridge north of camp. And there is, on the other side, the people in badges are setting up tents, it looks like, when I had looked at it. I don't know if anybody's occupying those tents, but I do see, if we had recalled not that long ago, that the bridge was trying to be unblocked by the people from the camps, and there were some severe repercussions by the police force.
Yeah, well, again, there are so many times when, because I saw that article go around really quickly, $1,000 fine for trying to deliver supplies, and one has to wonder if that's just to try to keep more people from coming out. So
I think that's part of it. And I think there's that element of control that, honestly, the powers in place tried to enforce that. We saw it right here in Portland. And here we are, primarily very open and liberal and progressive here. But as we had the announcement of Trump being the presidential candidate, there were understandably hundreds of thousands of people in contest of that. And these amazing marches were organized by some amazing leaders here locally. But the response that we ended up getting in one of the press conferences was our very own police force saying, yes, we acknowledge that you have free speech, but don't come out tonight. I feel like it was kind of that same tactic of, you know, we're acknowledging that you have these rights, but, you know, we're not actually in favor of that.
How do you think that some of the things that you have taken away from being a veteran has helped you with any of this, with any of your organizing work? Do you think that that has helped you in any way? And I'm not asking that question in a pro-military way.
As far as my involvement within,
I think
it's actually referred to it as the revolution.
I would
have to say that has created a strong foundation and an ability to work together with others, to sometimes step out in an uncomfortable, unsafe situation and stand alone for something that's right. And I think taking some of those skills into the work that I've done so far in outreach and social work, where I primarily use my organizational skills. I feel like putting these tools all together make me an ideal candidate to provide wherever I can for the progressive movement of our country.
What do you think that we could, because you're mostly involved, I would think, here in the local Portland area, what are some of the issues facing veterans that you've noticed here?
One of the biggest issues that I think we've seen as a city that's really, really out there is the homeless veteran population, the homeless population in general. I think Portland holds a lot of the same challenges that other cities do within our veteran population. I might be biased, but I feel like we have some pretty good services that we've grown ourselves as veterans within nonprofit groups and peer support groups and everything that I'm proud to say that we have that. But we still have all of the same issues. We still have post-traumatic stress disorder. We still have anxiety. We still have that the integration piece in finding employment and sustaining employment. And going back to school as a non-traditional student.
Mm-hmm. And it's estimated approximately a quarter of the homeless or houseless population, I'd like to say, here in the Portland area are veterans. And that's quite a large number. Almost a quarter of the people that you see in tents, they're veterans.
You really think about that ratio, because you think a quarter of this population, but how much of our population in the U.S. is comprised of veterans?
Well, for post-9/11 veterans, it's less than 1%.
Absolutely.
And for the rest, I'm not exactly sure of the number, but it's very, very small compared to the rest of the U.S.
Right, so you think of one of the smallest populations in the country is making up a large portion of the houseless population. I do find it hard to wrap my mind around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting too, and well, actually troubling, that female veterans are more at risk for houselessness as well as suicide. And these are just some of the things that people don't really think about as they're voting to either go to war or silent when that war is happening. It's something that we really need to be more aware of, how this impacts so many people. And I just wonder, are you connected with any First Nation Indigenous veterans here in the Portland area? Do you do any work with them?
Yes, I absolutely do. I called attention to their group a couple times earlier, the Northwest Indian Veterans Association.
Okay.
But I would have to say I definitely absolutely agree with you in understanding that within our political movement, realizing that there's a difference between pro-war and pro-service member.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that really does get lost in translation, as we've come to this place as a country, we're constantly on the offense and not the defense, and we're not defending the people that we're sending out there. And I think we've gotten to a point where we're really dehumanizing our service members, but then we're also simultaneously putting them on a pedestal and idolizing them. And it's a really strange place to be, and I don't feel that it's healthy. And there's a ranking structure of the impact of these negativities. And unfortunately, it's defined by your gender and your race and your class. And within these specific populations, such as the veteran population, there are a number of specific recurrent issues, but then you break that down even further. Like you said, you look into the difference between the statistics within the female gender or the male gender, and there's a difference there. But then you look at the population that we're not as used to openly talking about, and that's the LGBTQI population within the veteran group and the issues that they face. And so I think it's really important to remember this is a collective group of people, and that, yeah, there's unique needs, but some of them are even that much more impacted.
We only have a few minutes left. What are some of the things that you think that the general public listening here could benefit from knowing or being connected to, or some of the resources they might look into, something to either contribute them their time, or what can people do to become more involved in either Standing Rock or veterans issues? What do you think that people can do? Because I'm an action-oriented person. I think people should kind of do something sometimes. If you're going to recommend something, what do you think that would be?
Absolutely. And I admire that about you wholeheartedly. And I feel like those of us who do feel action-oriented, and, you know, what we can do is share that with others who might not think about that initially, and basically try to bring that unity. And I feel like a lot of this work is done on personal levels, at home, in your household, talking to your children, your family members, but also, you know, how you conduct yourself as a person out there in the world. But then also, you know, even go online and research, you know, the groups that are in your area. And Facebook and meetup.com are perfect for that. And I know there's Showing Up for Racial Justice, that group that just held an orientation this week that could give you lots of information about how you can actively be a proactive member of your society in your immediate area. And I feel like really looking into and understanding the indigeneity and that aspect as we move forward, and being more open to exploring that particular group of people can be really helpful. And I feel like that really brings such a human aspect to all of us.
Yeah, definitely there needs to be more unification going on, and education is at the core of that. I feel like, do you have any last thoughts or words before we close out our hour?
I would like to speak on something that maybe is a little more esoteric or whimsical, and I feel like a lot of other veterans have experienced this, and sometimes for some of these veterans, maybe even for the first time, is that a lot of us, specifically me, had shown up to Standing Rock feeling like this was going to be a very utilitarian mission. I came equipped with gas masks for myself and to share, for waterproof gear for myself and to share, and other protective gear that I was given by others to share. And what had actually ended up happening was so much more rich and complex than that, that a lot of people had recounted their feelings in the nature of like a level of spirituality that they feel like they will forever be changed being able to be a part of this, that there was such emotion and such honor in being involved with the indigenous tribes at Standing Rock and the tribes from all over the world that had joined at Standing Rock. And there were welcoming ceremonies to introduce the veterans to the land. And there was one particular moment where the veterans were bestowed a gift of an eagle feather, which is in very high regard in Native culture. And it's not to be taken lightly. And there were, there was just so much impact in that moment that a lot of us didn't expect to have.
Wow. That's really incredible. Well, we're going to have you back on at another time here in the studio. And I want to thank you for coming on today and sharing your story and perspective. So This is Angie Hines. This is Veterans Voice. We're going to be back on January 20th. And we want to thank everybody for listening. Marvin, we're out there for you. And we'll see you next time. And there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of
vengeance. Hey, listeners. Due to the holidays, the December KBOOT board meeting has been canceled. But don't worry, because we're going to have a makeup meeting between now and the next scheduled board meeting in January. You can go to KBOOT.fm for more information, or just tune into KBOOT 90.7 on your FM dial. What to do?